main thing. I think the concern when we make the statement like that is a lot of people are coming in and not integrating, and some of the tensions amongst different communities that exist outside of Canada are now appearing inside of Canada, and we feel that if somebody comes here, they want to come for a new life, not to bring their troubles with them. So that's the intent, and then looking at how it's managed would continually draw on the intent to make sure it doesn't go sideways. I'm a big fan of being aware of unintended consequences of when you think you have a great idea, and of monitoring the result to see what went right, what went wrong, and that's the kind of thing that would be applicable too.
The PPC has stated its intention to repeal the Multiculturalism Act, claiming it promotes division instead of unity. What would replacing multiculturalism with a singular Canadian identity look like in practice?
Well, we're not against multiculturalism. We're against the official policy of multiculturalism. So we encourage communities to keep their community centers and their community bonds and their tradition, but we don't want to fund and promote it above the theme of, hey, we're all Canadian, you know, and we all belong here, and this is us.
How would you address concerns from ethnocultural communities who see multiculturalism as a recognition of their place in Canada's social fabric?
I would just say we're in favor of equal rights, and you are recognized, and that is, I think, one of the strongest parts of our social fabric. And, you know, as a newcomer, sometimes it takes a few generations, and the children adapt. They always do, but for a newcomer, you're always going to have that connection with where you were born, and we don't want anyone to feel uncomfortable, but we definitely want to make them feel welcome. Trudeau is a person that I admired very little about, but when he first started, I'll give people credit where credit's due. When he first started, he did a little media stunt, but it worked. It impressed me. He went to the airport when refugees were arriving, and he met them at the gate and said, "Welcome home." And I was proud to see that. Then after that, not so much.
The PPC is one of the few parties that openly rejects climate change policies. Do you accept scientific consensus on human-caused climate change, such as the increase of CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide?
So I have a personal opinion, and we have a party opinion. And the party opinion is we're concerned about climate change hysteria. There's a lot of money being thrown around, a lot of rash decisions, and a lot of impact on the economy. And we need to be careful how we move on this, because our economy's already slipped from number 7 in developed nations to number 27 in 9 years. And it's not just that it slipped. It's descending rapidly. There's no bottom in sight. So we need to be very careful about the choices we make with regard to climate. I have seen many credible studies from many credible scientists that CO2 is not really causing a climate emergency. We have a natural cycle. We've got one of the lowest CO2 levels in millions of years. It's so traditionally of where it is. It would be normal for it to be going up on its own. The problem I see as an engineer is the scientists on both sides of the spectrum are not discussing it. Only one side gets funded. They both want to cancel each other, claiming that only their side can be considered. With one side getting funded and that kind of culture, scientists can't arrive at a conclusion. They can't debate things the way they should when you have a situation like that. My personal experience as an engineer, I review a lot of reports that are proposals for use of public lands, and I look out for the infrastructure and safety and whatnot. And a decade of that particular role, I got really good at sensing baloney. You can see when they're pulling on politicians or emotion, and I can read the conclusion, and right away red flags go up. And when I've seen this climate, the way they've analyzed it, I have red flags. And I don't claim to know it all, but we really need to bring the two sides together and openly work it out.
If not through carbon pricing or international agreements, what specific strategies would your party pursue to protect the environment and prepare for the impacts of climate change?
Right. So I don't believe a tax solves the climate change, right? You know, I saw a cartoon. I cracked up. It was a giant meteor headed for the Earth, and someone said, "It's okay. We're going to be all right. We're going to have a meteor tax." So being against it doesn't necessarily mean you're against the environment. I'm an outdoors person, and I care deeply about the environment, but I see different priorities. My own personal priorities: habitat destruction, overfishing, fishing, extinction of species. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe we should be putting funds and efforts into controlling those things, and funds and efforts into the climate debate. But shutting down our fossil fuels industry, I don't know that Canada can be economically viable if we do that. So if we have to do it, we need to be sure that that's going to be effective.
The PPC has openly opposed gender identity policies and what it describes as radical gender ideology. What policies would you support or repel in this area?
Mostly we're looking at the protection of women and girls. So safe spaces, women's washrooms and change rooms, women not having to compete against transgender in professional or amateur sports simply because it cuts them out of the competition. And so if they don't have a place to perform their sports, the bigger issue is, yeah, how do you include a transgender? But most of the female population, you know, people like to participate in sports. And if you're going to get clobbered, it needs to be addressed. That's what we're saying.
How would you respond to transgender Canadians and LGBTQ plus advocates who say these positions threaten their safety, dignity, and rights?
It's not the intent. I was out in the park the other day, and a transgender person took the time to thoughtfully discuss the issue with me for about an hour, and there was no harsh words. And in the end, I was told, "I don't think you guys are for me," and that's okay, right? But we had an open dialogue, and we were both comfortable with it, and I was heard.
Why do you think you're the best candidate to represent Burnaby as a member of Parliament for Burnaby Central?
I know the place well. Myself, my wife, my three boys, we're all born at Burnaby General. I've lived in the address that I'm in now for 20 years. I had previous political experience, but it was decades ago. I had a run when I was 33, but politics isn't something I looked at as a career option. I did it then, and I do it now because I need to contribute when I see something that I think is wrong. And most people you talk to now, you can take any of our policy issues, and people will, regardless of whether they have a favorite or not, they're concerned. They're concerned that in the last 5 years, things are going off the rails and nobody's talking about their concerns. The PPC was started because our leader, who was a senior cabinet minister in the Conservatives, saw all three parties taking the same line. They take turns in power, and they talk a little different, but when it came to action, they just did the same thing because they take polls and they just react to the polls. They don't actually have a stance. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to give people a choice. If you want a voice, and we'd like to be a voice to bring up certain issues, even if we're just a few seats in Parliament, because getting the debate going, I think, is half the battle. It's people that need to resolve these issues, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
That was Richard Farbridge, candidate for the People's Party of Canada for the riding of Burnaby Central. In advance of Canada's April 28th federal election, CJSF reached out to candidates from the four federal ridings representing Burnaby: Burnaby North Seymour, Burnaby Central, Vancouver Fairview South Burnaby, and New Westminster Burnaby Myardville. Between now and the day of the election, CJSF will be sharing interviews with the candidates who got back to us.
I'm James Horncastle. I'm an assistant professor in the Global Humanities Department at Simon Fraser University. My specialty involves international relations, with a particular focus on population movements, national identity, and conflict studies.
All right, thank you. So I'll be asking you more about the international relations regarding U.S. and Canada and the upcoming elections and how this is going to affect us, basically.
Sure, that sounds good.
how has the return of the Trump administration influenced Canada-U.S. relations compared to previous years?
I think it's a major kind of turning point in relations between the United States and Canada. Prior to the return of Trump, there was relatively amicable relations between Canada and the United States. They did not always end up agreeing on the same points. Most notably, we see this playing out, for example, going all the way back to Jean Chrétien, the decision not to get involved in Iraq. There's been a kind of fundamental shift, however, with Donald Trump. Specifically, Donald Trump is kind of embracing this kind of almost isolationist policy within the United States, which is actually directly impacting Canada due to the fact that our economies are heavily integrated with one another. And this kind of blanket kind of focus upon the U.S. attempts to restore kind of industrial production to the United States is directly harming Canada. This does not even go into, for example, what I suspect first started as a joke, his 51st state comments, and then has been something that has picked up over and over again. So it's been a fundamental shift within the relations between the two countries.
In what ways has the Trump leadership style affected diplomatic communication or trust between, like, us and them?
In a number of ways. So first of all, is kind of Trump's own personal style. He tends to pivot with alarming regularity on ideas. Typically within international relations, we see these are kind of long-term deals playing out between countries, take a fair degree of time to negotiate kind of the finer points of various agreements. With Donald Trump at the helm, it's almost been a pivot, I don't want to say daily, but in some instances daily, basically on certain policies. There's been assumption, for example, regarding tariffs that's going to end up impacting certain aspects of the economy. It's said later that day that, no, they're not. And then the next morning, there's something on basically his Truth social media that actually it is impacting it. There's these various back and forth kind of chaotic communication styles that I suspect is almost a deliberate policy on the Trump administration's part because they like to be seen as unpredictable and it allows them to end up controlling the narrative. But simultaneously, this is A, damaging relations between not only Canada and U.S., but U.S. and other countries globally, and making kind of any long-term planning between Canada and the U.S. difficult, if not impossible, due to the fact that you can't kind of rely upon previous agreements.
Yeah. What is the impact of the Trump administration's recent tariff threats on Canada's economy and trade policy?
It's quite a severe impact, to be perfectly honest, upon Canada. As I mentioned earlier, our economies are heavily integrated going back to NAFTA. Even a little bit beforehand, there was much more integration than like what we usually pretend. But especially with the North American Free Trade Agreement and then NAFTA 2.0, which was actually signed under Trump, the two economies are very much integrated. Canada is now trying to face the reality of much of our kind of exports, much of our resources were actually kind of driven towards the United States. Canada, traditionally, at least over the past 30 years, has not been a major industrial producer, but instead ships many of the raw materials produced in Canada to the United States for further refinement. So I think the first thing that you will see is Canada trying to end up introducing some of that secondary manufacturing process to the country. It's going to take time, to be perfectly honest. You can't build a factory overnight and then immediately increase production. So that will be the kind of first long-term effort. The second is trying to end up increasing trade with countries beyond the United States. As I mentioned, we're heavily tied to the United States. Part of the way of trying to mitigate some of the risks involved is going to other trading partners. In particular, we're going to see a focus upon the European Union within kind of more of the kind of popular rhetoric. The one problem is Canada doesn't necessarily produce a lot that necessarily the EU needs immediately. So I think in reality, you'll see Canada try to pivot trade as much as possible towards Asia. Japan, Korea emerging as likely markets, China potentially as well. although Canada's diplomatic relationship with China is rather tense at the moment. So we will have to see how that develops with the ongoing kind of trade conflict between not only Canada and the United States, but China and the United States and the Canada and Chinese relations as well.
All right. Which industries are being hit the hardest, and how is Canada responding to it by removing U.S. products? And how do they think that's going to, like, you know, solve the issue, basically?
This is the billion-dollar question, to be perfectly honest. In terms of kind of the areas where Canada is immediately being impacted, we're going to see this in particular for aluminum and steel. We already have specific tariffs on aluminum and steel. And one of the major problems is that actually products tend to go back and forth between Canada and the United States multiple times when it comes to aluminum and steel. There's various kind of refining processes. So it's those industries are going to be impacted significantly. In terms of how Canada's trying to offset it, there's not an immediate solution to it, to be perfectly honest. The tariffs and counter tariffs that Canada end up imposing are almost ones that they feel are political necessity, as otherwise it'll be perceived that the government is not doing enough. But on the other hand, that actually ends up increasing some of the potential complications for many of the industries on this side of the border. I suspect that you'll start to see governments, both the federal level and provincial, try to end up establishing funds in order to support these industries. There's already been tentative moves in this regard. In particular, Ontario's been at the forefront of this, given its kind of heavy industrial center. But this is going to require a concerted effort between the federal government and the provinces. And since we're in the middle of an election cycle right now, there hasn't been too much progress on that front, because you don't want to negotiate with the government and potentially have a new government come involved and overturn much of its development.
Yeah. Anyway, next is, will Canadian officials, like, increase their retaliation to all of this?
I think there's only a certain point that Canadian officials can end up increasing retaliation. On the one hand, I understand the sentiment, given the rhetoric, given the damage that basically Donald Trump's policies are doing in Canada. One wants to strike back as much as possible. One has to remember, though, that Canada is quite a bit smaller in terms of population, economy, et cetera, than the United States. So the amount that we can fight back is rather limited. So what you're going to see is kind of Canada be rather smart in the various kind of tariffs and kind of countermeasures that are imposed. But it can't go on a one-to-one basis, because if Canada goes on a one-to-one basis with the United States over the long term, it's not a winning formula, to be honest.
All right. With Trump suggesting punitive tariffs if Canada does not align with certain U.S. policies, how has this pressure shaped the Canadian federal election?
It's had a major impact upon the federal election, to be honest. One of the issues that we saw coming up with regards to the federal election is that more or less the Liberal Party was basically almost in a losing position by January. Donald Trump has kind of completely turned things around, to be perfectly honest. First under Justin Trudeau, we saw the Liberal Party really kind of position itself as a champion of kind of Canadian first issues. And the Liberal Party has done a good job of tying Pierre Poilievre to Trump more broadly. And this has basically kind of completely shifted the electoral landscape into the point that most polls have the Liberals currently winning a majority government. We still have a week to go for the election, and a lot can happen within a week. But if we're talking about the major shift in story, it's that the Conservatives went from before Trump to having most likely a majority to now most likely not being able to even win a minority government within the election. But we shall see. We can't kind of count everything before the ballots are cast at this point.
Are Canadian parties using this issue to rally support or draw contrasts in their platform?
Oh, very much so. As I mentioned, the Liberal Party has kind of really draped the Canadian flag around itself in terms of its policies, standing up for Canadians. They got into a little bit of trouble with the whole button affair, if you heard about that. Where
No, I don't think so.
There was a conservative meeting. Many members of the Conservative Party were there, and members of Liberal staff distributed buttons, kind of trying to emphasize the ties between Donald Trump and Pierre Poilievre and some of the policies.
Oh, okay. I think I have.
Yeah, so they kind of operationalized this completely. We see the conservatives now trying to pivot, whereas before, Pierre Poilievre almost seemed slightly hopeful that he'd be able to end up working with Trump. He's now trying to position himself as the individual who can best stand up to Trump. So far, that message hasn't been hitting home as much as I think he wants it to. But we'll see in the last week if he can kind of try to hammer home to Canadians that he can stand up to Trump versus Carney, or Canadians are going to decide that Carney is the individual best able to stand up. Now, I'm also leaving out, for example, the NDP and the Bloc Québécois. The NDP are having a rather difficult time at the moment, to be honest, in terms of the election. I suspect it's in part due to their previous agreement with the Liberal Party, and then more or less being left to kind of hold on to the previous policies of government, given Jagmeet Singh is still the leader of the NDP, where Trudeau is gone. And in the case of the Bloc Québécois, they are very much just trying to maintain their hold within Quebec, because Carney has been making significant gains there over basically the previous month or two.
All right. How has the rhetoric and unpredictability from the Trump administration changed how Canadian leaders approach diplomacy with the U.S.?
I think there's been a kind of a fundamental shift in terms of how diplomacy ends up being conducted, in part because of Trump's style. We see basically the Canadian government almost knowing that, you know, Trump is relatively unpredictable in a lot of ways. They're trying to end up building ties between not necessarily Trump, but people within his near orbit, for lack of a better term, in order to perhaps put in some good words for Canada should the need end up arising based off these tensions. Dominic LeBlanc, who's an MP from my part of Canada, originally in New Brunswick, he's kind of been at the forefront of these endeavors. But we've also seen the Canadian government, for example, trying to basically hire certain lobbying groups to end up impacting. The other initiative that the Canadian government has undertaken is that instead of negotiating directly with Trump, they're almost trying to negotiate more with kind of the American electorate. Over the past month, the Canadian government has taken out a number of billboards in traditionally red states, so traditionally Republican states within the United States, emphasizing kind of benefits that end up happening between trade from Canada to the United States and vice versa, how basically both countries end up benefiting from this. Because they recognize that Trump is very much kind of a populist leader, and if the people start to end up getting upset with Trump, he will pivot relatively quickly to a new policy in order to try to maintain that support. So very much kind of indirect diplomacy going on right now.
Yeah. Is there also like any evidence of a shift towards more defensive or like a cautious foreign policy on Canada's part, military-wise or just like in general?
This was already starting a little bit, I would say, before Trump came to power. Really, it kind of kicked off once you saw that Trump had actually won the presidential election in November. And this has to do with how much Canada ends up spending on defense. Canada traditionally has been one of the states that has spent the least amount of its GDP per capita on defense issues. I think that Canadian officials recognize that defense spending is one of kind of Trump's red lines that he remains fixated on, much like tariffs. So one way of trying to kind of appease Trump, for lack of a better term, is by increasing spending upon defense. We saw this notably during the Liberals' proposed budget, where they've noted that there is a plan to end up increasing Canada's defense spending up to the NATO minimum of 2%. Whether this is actually an effective kind of tool for assuaging Trump, we'll see. But in terms of kind of broader diplomatic relations, because we've been entering into a federal election, there hasn't been too much push I mean, there's been efforts to try to build and increase Canada's ties with other countries outside the United States. But really, it's going to come down to the next government and kind of what direction they want to take with regards to international developments to see if the Trump administration causes a profound shift in kind of Canada's stance.
Yeah. What risks do escalating trade tensions with the U.S. pose for Canada's internal political stability or regional economies?
Quite a bit, to be perfectly honest. I actually wrote an article for The Conversation kind of with some of the potential complications caused by the tariffs. Most likely, based off the tariffs, Canada is heading towards a recession. It's almost unavoidable to get away from a recession based off the tariffs, especially if they start to come into a greater degree. And one of the things that economic prosperity does is it helps assuage many of the kind of tensions that exist within various kind of polities. And I think you're starting to already see this emerge in Canada, most notably with Manning saying that, you know, a vote against or a vote for the Liberals will end up stoking Western secessionist ideology. Well, you can question kind of the wisdom of him saying so, because in so saying, he actually ends up stoking it himself. I suspect you'll see regional tensions start to emerge because the provinces are relatively limited in their taxation under Canada's constitution. So this is going to directly end up impacting their bottom line. Also, the federal government is going to have less money to end up distributing. And any time that money ends up being distributed between provinces, tensions emerge. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that we'll see regional tensions kind of become highlighted over the next 6 months, unfortunately.
Oh, all right.
Not that happy a picture, I know, sorry.
Yeah. Are we seeing, like, increased calls for protectionism or diversification within Canada?
We're seeing a little bit in terms of kind of protectionist policies start to be called for, especially by the industries that are most heavily affected by these kind of tariff threats, and not only tariff threats, but actually implemented tariffs. We're certainly seeing calls for diversification in terms of Canada's trade. For a lot of basically Canada's history, we've been a primary resource extracting country. As a primary resource extracting country, I don't know why I keep saying company, but anyways. But as a country that does so, we're kind of limited in terms of our markets that we can end up trading with because only so many countries need these goods. If we can start to diversify our manufacturing capabilities, it increases the number of countries that we can potentially trade with. There's a recognition of this amongst various Canadian companies. There, got it right this time. So once we start to see this kind of build up, I suspect that you'll see the next government try to end up encouraging this because it'll also be a way of potentially generating jobs in the short term as we deal with the economic fallout of basically the tariffs.
All right, so last question. Looking ahead, what might be the consequences for Canada-U.S. relations if Trump continues with his whole Canada is like the 51st state rhetoric or the tariffs, and if Canada elects a government with opposing views?
I think you're going to see increased kind of distance between the two countries. It'll be difficult for Canada to pivot back to the relations that it had with the United States beforehand, because of the relative uncertainty of the U.S. electoral cycle. Every 4 years, you're dealing with a potentially new government with radically different policies. So the long-term kind of damage that Trump has done can't be underestimated. I suspect that should there be a government that within 4 years that Canada is a bit more amenable to, Canada, of course, will start dealing with them in a more kind of equitable manner. But I don't see a return to kind of the previous relations that Canada and U.S. had, at least in the near to midterm.
Mm-hmm. Could we see like a diplomatic chill or a policy standoffs?
I think we're already starting to see those, to be perfectly honest, in a lot of ways. So there, under Carney, there was at least a little bit of improvement in Canadian-U.S. relations. I think in part because much of Trump and Trudeau had not only diametrically different views, but also diametrically different styles. Once Carney came in, there seemed to be a little bit better working relationship between the two. I'm not sure I could speculate on the reasons why. I mean, one could, but it wouldn't be based necessarily in kind of evidence.
Thanks to Jamie Horncastle for joining Senya for that interview. Just had to cut off the last minute or so as we're out of time here this hour. If you want to hear the whole thing, you can go to cjsf.ca. I'm Jesse. This has been Speak Up, and up next is Democracy Now! Stick around.